This edition of Monocle on Saturday was first broadcast on Saturday, the 4th of July, 2020, on Monocle 24. Good morning, I'm Georgina Godwin, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. This is Monocle on Saturday. On the show ahead, we'll go through the newspapers to make sense of what's going on in the world before joining Anushka Warden. She's a writer and producer, and she's behind the Lockdown Plays, a charitable initiative bringing work to you from some really good writers, read by some really good actors. Then Monocle's Andrew Muller will recap the past 7 days for us on this week's What We Learned.
Of the many reasons to be concerned about Putin bricking himself in, high among them is the prospect that he might have given his American counterpart ideas, and it wouldn't be the first time, am I right?
We also speak to Philip Jones, editor of The Bookseller, sponsor of the British Book Awards, the leading prizes for the book trade, celebrating the best books, the best bookshops, and the best publisher. We'll discuss the winners. And finally, we'll hear from our editor, Andrew Tuck.
The trouble is that cities are at their humming, spinning, gyrating peaks when theatres are open, cinemas packed, clubs jumping and bars rammed. They need a sense of possibility on the breeze.
Join me on Monocle on Saturday to hear that and much more. First, here are the headlines. England takes its biggest steps yet towards resumption of normal life today, as people are finally allowed to drink in a pub, get a haircut, or have a meal in a restaurant for the first time in over 3 months. President Donald Trump's railed against angry mobs that tried to tear down statues of Confederate leaders and other historical figures, warning thousands of supporters at Mount Rushmore that protesters were trying to erase US history. North Korea doesn't feel the need to have talks with the United States, which would be nothing more than a political tool for Washington, a senior North Korean diplomat said today, ahead of a US envoy's visit to South Korea. And in our weekend edition bulletin, find out why washing machines drove our North America correspondent out of New York and the correct way to address Mr. Etiquette's cat. That's your Monocle 24 news. Well, it's time now to have a browse through the morning newspapers, and I'm joined by Charles Hecker, who's a senior partner at Control Risks. Good morning, Charles. I've missed you.
Yes, Georgina. Good morning. I miss you very much as well, and I'm very jealous to know that you're actually in the studios at Monocle 24. And if you have a cardamom bun next to you, just don't tell me about it.
Charles, it's July the 4th, and of course you're American. And what I suddenly remembered was, of course, last July the 4th, you and I went to the U.S. Ambassador's party to celebrate it together.
I was similarly reminiscing, and I was thinking about the fireworks, and I was thinking about the music. I was thinking about some of the glitterati, the political glitterati that we ran into as we were sort of browsing and grazing at all of the different food stands. It was a very, very nice London summer evening.
It was lovely, and pretty much unlike the weather today, I have to say. But anyway, happy 4th of July to you. How has President Trump been celebrating it?
Well, so first of all, it was very kind of you at the top of the broadcast to say that we were going to look at today's papers to try to understand the world around us. That's quite ambitious, but we'll have a go. So the president began celebrating the 4th of July by a trip to Mount Rushmore in South Dakota, where he made a landmark speech and entertained the crowds, and there was a fireworks display. And there are any number of ways of getting into this event in the papers. And I've gone to the New York Times, which tells us, among everything else, which we'll get to in a second, the headline is that Kimberly Guilfoyle, top fundraising official for Trump campaign, tests positive for coronavirus. And the Times then tells us that Ms. Guilfoyle is the third person in close proximity of President Trump known to have contracted the virus. And that's on top of the fact that one of the president's own valets, one of the gentlemen who serves in dinner, tested positive, and also Mike Pence's press secretary tested positive. And one of the things that the Times doesn't tell us until we get into you know, the text of the piece is that Kimberly Guilfoyle, of course, is the girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr., President Trump's eldest son. And so, of course, this is somebody very, very much in the inner circle of the president, his family, and his entourage. This was discovered as she was on the trip to South Dakota. She and Donald Trump Jr. left the venue. They've returned home. They will both be quarantining. The president's son has tested negative so far. But again, you know, as the United States debates how best to protect itself from the virus, is it social distancing? Is it hand washing? Is it wearing a mask? None of which appears to be really happening under the Trump administration. Here we've got another person in the entourage testing positive.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And Trump's still not really wearing a mask or visibly taking any precautions.
No, that's right. And apparently the crowds out at Mount Rushmore in South Dakota themselves were not taking any precautions. There were very few masks. There were no provisions even for social distancing as far as the seating was arranged. And, you know, the evening turned into one of these, you know, the event turned into one of these moments when President Trump ignored the virus and talked instead. And here's a quote from another story from the New York Times about the event. The president read in his speech, he said, "Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children." You know, a speech that's beginning to sound incredibly authoritarian and really taking the dogmatic aspect of the president's rhetoric to a completely new level.
Absolutely. I mean, read the room, man. That could not be, it's so far from how most people are feeling.
Well, exactly right. I mean, the United States public is beginning to react to the fact that the president doesn't appear to be in touch with the course of the virus. And, you know, numbers are through the roof now in the United States, and the increase in the infection rate now is genuinely exponential. In fact, the United States infection rate, and sooner or later the death rate will catch up with this, the infection rate now is actually higher than it was at the outset of the pandemic when it first began to materialize in the United States. And the public is sensing that the president is out of touch with this. He's out of touch with the statistics, and he's also out of touch with the human element and a recognition of the number of people who are genuinely falling severely ill and suffering, you know, the physical and economic impact of the pandemic.
And he's also very much out of touch with how people feel about history, and his attack on what he's calling culture wars is extraordinary.
Well, that's right. He's calling these, you know, statues and monuments and history, you know, he's calling these monuments to heroes. And you'll know that the statues that have come down in public venues are statues of people who bought and sold other people. And so, you know, it's difficult to call those people heroes now. You wonder why they were ever called heroes. And this is a historical and cultural reckoning in the United States that might have and perhaps should have taken place a very long time ago. And the president is putting this in a context that doesn't resonate with people who finally see an advance of political and social justice on the issue of race in the United States. And what the president is relentlessly trying to do is cast this as a law and order issue. And it really isn't. It's a social justice issue. And I think the public is on that side and again senses that this is an issue that the president is out of touch with.
Yeah. Well, let's look at a law and order issue, because the Japan Times is talking about Carlos Ghosn and his escape. And apparently a pilot has said that he helped him.
That's right. We're going to the Japan Times website with a story that seems like it comes from another era. But, you know, cast your mind back to December and January December of last year and January of this year with a story that absolutely riveted the world. And that is the escape of Carlos Ghosn from house arrest in Tokyo. Carlos Ghosn, of course, was atop the Nissan Renault automotive empire, but was under house arrest facing criminal charges on fraud in Japan, but he escaped. And what's happened now in Istanbul is that the trial of the charter company, the aircraft management company that got him out, allegedly, is underway. And what's happening is the manager of that company and the individual who's charged as one of the individuals who masterminded this great escape. And you'll remember there were rumors that he was smuggled out in a musical instrument case or in a musical equipment case and you know, right out from under the nose of people who were following his every move. This aircraft manager is saying that he had no idea that Carlos Ghosn was on the aircraft until he was informed by somebody else once the plane was in the air. Prosecutors in Istanbul are saying that he knew all along and that everyone else on the aircraft, including the pilots, knew all along, that even the flight attendants who were there were meant to have reported that this was going on. They've been charged with failure to report a crime. And so you've got quite an elaborate prosecution taking place in the courts in Istanbul. But the mastermind of all this, the alleged mastermind of all of this, is saying he didn't know. There's a fairly humorous subtext to all of this because, of course, as this operation was underway, everyone is texting each other by WhatsApp, how else? And they're accusing the aircraft manager of using code to text back and forth and using phrases like the luggage and the consignment. And prosecutors are saying that, of course, these are veiled and coded references to Carlos Ghosn. The aircraft manager is saying no, he actually had a consignment of sake on the aircraft and was curious about whether or not it made it onto the plane and would soon be delivered to Istanbul.
That's extraordinary. Charles, we've run out of time, which is very sad because so much more still to unpick in the papers. But I know that we'll have you back on the programme again very soon. And happy 4th of July to you once again.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to coming back soon. Thanks, Georgina.
That was Charles Hecker from Control Risks. You're listening to Monocle on Saturday. Well, you've heard the main stories from today, but what about the ones making the headlines all week? Here's Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller, with this week's What We Learned.
We learned this week that we will need to get used to President Vladimir Putin of Russia. Russians voted on Wednesday on constitutional reforms which will theoretically extend Putin's lease on the Kremlin from 2024 to 2036. There were few, if any, reports of Russians staying up all night to watch the results come in, and fewer still of bookmakers offering odds on whether or not a grateful people would respond positively to the noble offer of their selfless president to sacrifice his retirement to ensure the continuity of their munificent government. Here's Luke Harding, author of Shadow State, on Wednesday's briefing.
He's going to out-Stalin Stalin. He will be in the Kremlin until his 70s, possibly even his early 80s, and will clearly see off Donald Trump. Whatever happens in November, he'll see off Boris Johnson. And he's actually a dictator. I mean, that really is the word for it, because political opposition in Russia has been squashed, real opposition, over the last two decades, quite systematically. First of all, it affects new generation of Russians who want change, want something different, and who are fed up with the kind of Putin system. So they will suffer first and foremost, but also it means some of the crazy things the Kremlin has been doing with its spies in recent years, trying to hack and sabotage and subvert the West, all of that will continue.
Of the many reasons to be concerned about Putin bricking himself in, high among them is the prospect that he might have given his American counterpart ideas, and it wouldn't be the first time, am I right? There, that's the kind of edgy satire that keeps you coming back. US President Benito Cartman, who long ago voyaged valiantly beyond the boundaries which once defined the limits of self-parody, found himself this week having to send his current letter-turner, Kayleigh McEnany, into the White House briefing room to announce that the President of the United States does, in fact, read. Not a doubt that was ever raised about any of his predecessors.
The president does read, and he also consumes intelligence verbally.
We'd also learned earlier this week that the Rolling Stones are threatening to sue President Trump for the unsanctioned use of their songs at his yokel rodeos. We learned subsequent to that that the Stones may have an unlikely partner in any future class action, the Islamic Republic of Iran. And in deference to their pious sensibilities, we should probably yank the music round about here. Iran issued a warrant for Trump's arrest in the case of the assassination of former Quds Force commander General Qasem Soleimani, killed by a US drone strike in Baghdad in January.
Prosecutors in Tehran say Trump, along with more than 30 others, were involved in the January 3 attack that assassinated Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and his companions. For the same reason, they say all these individuals face murder and terrorism charges.
Tehran has requested a red notice be put out for Trump and the others, the highest-level notice issued by Interpol, that seeks the location and arrests of the individuals named.
We learned, however, that the chances of U.S. Marshals marching Trump out of the White House in cuffs at Tehran's behest are slenderish at best. Interpol swiftly intimated that they intended to regard this as the approximate equivalent of someone dialing 999 about a missing snowman in March. Trump, almost disappointingly, has not responded directly to Iran's threat, possibly because it was written down. Do you see how skillfully we stitched this all together? And if Trump has said something in the interregnum between the recording and broadcast of this, live with it. Elsewhere, we learned that we have not yet seen the end of the redecorations which have been a feature of the recent worldwide Black Lives Matter protests.
Don't be angry with me, darling, if I fail to understand.
Some of these have been, in the circumstances, probably unsurprising, if nevertheless powerful. In Richmond, Virginia, one-time capital of the Confederate States, Mayor LeVar Stoney ordered the removal of several rebel monuments, including a statue of Confederate General Stonewall Jackson. Not to be confused, obviously, with the Stonewall Jackson, the honky-tonk singer, most popular circa the early 1960s, who you can hear in the background and which we are pointing out so you can fully appreciate how very clever this is. But we learned that some aesthetic adjustments were occurring further afield, and what seems kind of like maybe a few decades overdue? Well, sort of. While we did learn this week that Finland's Air Force had dropped the swastika from its insignia, and we will come back to that, we also learned, if we read past this week's headlines, that Finland's Air Force actually did this about 3 years ago, but very quietly. It is an open question whether the very quietly part was canny public relations or just standard Finnish taciturnity. These are people generally reluctant to speak up, even if their trousers are on fire. Here is Monocle's resident Finn, Markus Hippi, performing an impression of a Finnish person noticing that their trousers are on fire.
Anteeksi, excuse me.
Anyway, we learned, once we'd burrowed down to about paragraph 6 in this week's stories, that in 1918 Finland was given a fighter plane by Erik von Rosen, an eccentric Swedish count who had adopted the then inoffensive swastika as a motif and had painted one on the fuselage. The nascent Finnish Air Force kept the design. They scrubbed it from their aircraft after World War II, but not from some badges and flags. Which is weird, but in terms of persistently embracing embarrassing cultural artifacts with which no decent person should any longer wish to be associated, not as weird as. We learned that in spite of medical and indeed all other common sense, bad in the 90s rapper Vanilla Ice intends to proceed with an Independence Day weekend concert in the COVID-19 hot zone of Texas. So we learned that this is how, if all tickets are sold, perhaps 2,500 Americans will acknowledge the birth of their republic. We may only hope that ICE's base is all but drowned out by the rumble of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Thomas Paine turning in their tombs. for Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you very much to Andrew. You're listening to Monocle on Saturday with me, Georgina Godwin. And I'm now joined by Anushka Warden. Now, she is a performer, a writer and a producer. She's been doing some really exciting work. Anushka, welcome. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak to us today.
Hi.
Let's begin with the lockdown plays. What are they?
The lockdown plays are a podcast that myself and actors Tom Mothersdale and Wilf Scolding created at the start of our lockdown here in the UK, so at the beginning of March. And I had produced a podcast for the Royal Court Theatre with Simon Stevens called the Playwrights Podcast. So I kind of found it like a easy form to think of in this time. And we very much, there were lots of conversations in our industry about how at that point of the pandemic, it's just not not an appropriate thing to be asking artists to create work when they're probably just trying to work out all the same things other people are, how to survive, how to look after their family. So we thought of the podcast plays to be like smaller work that existed but had never had a life, because lots of writers might write scenes or things that are never maybe long enough to be full plays. And we like the idea of being able to host it in a podcast format where it's like the first day of rehearsals, because on that day you know you're not being directed, you're sitting down, you're maybe doing a read through. So it was very much sort of a rough offering in that time, and we wanted to link it to a cause that would be helpful, which was St Mungo's, a homeless charity who were doing a lot of frontline work with getting, you know, rough sleepers off the street during that time.
And I love the sort of feel of it. It's very informal, as you say, first day of rehearsal kind of vibe going on. But the sort of chat with the writers and with the performers, and it's not just straight into a kind of stage reading. There's a lot of conversation about where the work comes from and how people are feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I think like probably about halfway through the 10 episode series, we probably worked out exactly what the structure and form of the podcast was. So I think that is an interesting thing with the podcast format. You kind of don't know exactly what you need it to be until you've done a few. And I think we just set up with the principle of some kind of chat, which was kind of weird not to talk about, you know, the lockdown, and then trying to kind of get into just doing the readings quite quickly. But we had interesting responses. Some people loved the chat, and other people were like, oh, it's a bit sort of rubbish, you should have just got straight to the place.
How much of the material was written specifically for this project?
Well, the three of us asked the writers to, we specifically asked them not to create something new, because we didn't have money to pay them. So, you know, ethically, that's not cool. And B, that thing of not wanting someone to feel like they had to be creative. So we very much left it to them. And as it happens, three out of 10 had literally just written something, not for us, but had just finished it. So they were like, you can have that. And then one of the playwrights did actually write something specific for it. And then the other sort of 50%, it might have been just things over the last few years. But just that sort of offer to the audience that it was work that hadn't been, you know, hadn't really been heard before.
Well, I really recommend it to listeners, the lockdown plays. Now, you're a writer yourself, and your show, My Mum's a Twat, has done very well. Tell us about it. Your mother joined a cult, moved to Canada, took up with a guy who was a moron. Tell us more.
I mean, I very much write it like a play. So the main character is called Girl, and my type of writing, I only started writing a couple of years ago, like had never written anything before. So again, I'm just starting to understand what I write, which I would call autofiction. I don't know if anyone else in the theatre industry would identify with that, but for me, that means the work is really based on stuff I have, you know, almost firsthand experienced through me or my family. But then the fiction bit means, you know, there's stuff in there that's not accurate. So I always find it very hot. Find like there's a responsibility not to be like, it's 100% autobiographical, because like my memory is awful. My sister was like, read one bit and was like, that bit didn't happen. And I was like, oh, I thought it did. You know, like that's life, isn't it? But so yeah, with My Mum's a Twat, it is about the main character's mother joining what I would call a cult. But you know, that word is interpreted differently by different people, especially those who might be in one. Yeah, the mother joining a cult and starting a new version of it in Canada and leaving the girl when she was 12. And then it's, yeah, the thing I've discovered about my writing is I can't really do sentimental. I can only really write in a sort of, not like, I don't know what the word is, but I write about quite like potentially traumatic things, but in a light way, but not because I'm trying to make light of it. It's just, I guess that's just my personality.
Finally, Anushka, I know you can't speak for the whole industry, and at the start of your career, it must be very daunting to see all of these theatres shutting, and some of them, in fact, won't be coming back. Now, I know there's a huge move and appeal to Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, to fund culture. But this is a really worrying state of affairs, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think the worrying thing is people in theatre know how to be resourceful. They know how to be creative and make great plans. But without, you know, without a proper, without a clear timeline from the government about when venues can reopen without social distancing, and therefore alongside that, what a financial support packages, yeah, like theatres like the Theatre Royal Plymouth and Birmingham Hippodrome, and I think yesterday the Royal Exchange Manchester is saying they're having to start a redundancy process on like 65% of their permanent roles. Like these places are key, and I pick specifically the regional, you know, outside of London places, because they're all like, you know, their civic hubs and the work they do in the community, which is often the work that can look a bit hidden, but really crucial for, you know, the more vulnerable people in a community. Like, I just don't know what this will mean for us as a society if they all get wiped out.
And it's a debate that will be ongoing, I'm quite sure. Anushka, thank you for coming to talk to us. That's Anushka Warden. Her play is called My Mum's a Twat, and you can also hear the lockdown plays. Just Google that and they'll pop up. Well worth a listen. Well, it's time now to catch up with our editor, Andrew Tuck. Here he is with his weekly column.
It happened in cities all over the world, but here's a moment when I noticed a switch taking place in London. It was 1993. I was working at Time Out magazine and got an invite to see a new concept in London living, the city's very first loft apartments. I cycled over from the magazine's offices on Tottenham Court Road and met the two young developers, Harry Handelsman and John Hitchcox, at their project in Summer Street in Clerkenwell. They showed me around the old printworks and explained the idea. They would run the services to the front door, but you'd do almost everything else with the help of an architect. The shell units started at £80,000. I haven't been able to find the piece that I wrote. Clearly, it would have been very clever, but I did locate another report that ran in the Independent newspaper and noted buyers' enthusiasm for a relatively unfashionable backwater of central London. And it was true. Clerkenwell had watch repairers, printers, greasy spoon cafes, a rave club, a nice church or two, and the vestiges of a once strong Italian community. But there was no real reason to go there. But that project lit a touch paper, even in the depths of a terrible house price slump. Soon, the area's old buildings were being snapped up and converted at an incredible pace. Even the dinkiest pad would soon be marketed as a warehouse-style conversion. Within just a few years, Clerkenwell was both highly desirable and, yes, fashionable. Next came the Hoxton boom, as art galleries took over its industrial spaces. Then Hackney, Spitalfields and beyond, as the city pivoted east. Yes, this all came with challenges, but it also saw an explosion of restaurants, nice offices, clubs and entertainment. And it was all part of a rekindled desire to live in the midst of the action. The timing was also perfect. People weren't settling down until they were in their 30s, but they had good careers, so the lure of inner city life and a loft apartment put suburbia on hold. You can hear this same story in LA or Sao Paulo, how a regeneration rediscovered living in the heart of the city, how they were willing to compromise on space and a garden for access to some excitement, culture, and the frisson of being part of the action. Downtown was even championed as the best place for seniors. Don't rot in the countryside. Keep living central. And if you have a heart attack, be grateful you are close to a hospital. But now? In the UK, property search companies are reporting that inner city dwellers are frantically looking for homes in the suburbs, shaken by their garden-free lockdowns. Pundits are predicting that we will see an exodus of the young and the talented, that inner cities will lose their appeal as people avoid public transport, refuse to return to their office towers, and in turn ensure the demise of numerous stores and restaurants that lured them there in the first place. But will city living really lose its allure for this dynamic set? I've spoken to lots of people who headed to country cottages, for example, during lockdown, and not all of them have glowing reviews. Too many angry locals who suddenly didn't like anyone in the village whose family hadn't lived there for 300 years. And really, suburbia? People fought hard to escape a life of mowing the lawn and fitting in. The trouble is that cities are at their humming, spinning, gyrating peaks when theatres are open, cinemas packed, clubs jumping and bars rammed. They need a sense of possibility on the breeze. While all of these lures slumber, cities will be challenged and, yes, will lose some good people to suburban dreams and their newfound passions for pickling and polishing the SUV. Back in 1993, I left that old Printworks in Summer Street, got on my bicycle and, as I cycled back to the office, thought, I'd like to live in the heart of the city one day. And somehow, it's happened. So while the city may be taking its time to burn bright again, I'm confident it will, and I'll be here, ready to embrace all that it has and maybe even offer the spare room to suburban friends who've missed the last train back to tranquility. And even if it does dip, then there will be another generation of entrepreneurial developers and architects who will seize the moment and trigger a revival. It will all work out. The city cannot be beaten.
Many thanks to our editor, Andrew Tuck. And for more from our editors and correspondents, sign up to the Monocle Minute at monocle.com/minute. This is Monocle on Saturday. I'm Georgina Godwin. Now, the British Book Awards, or NBBYs, have been the leading awards for the book trade since 1990, celebrating the best books, the best bookshops and the best publishers. It's supported by all major industry associations. It's judged by leading industry experts and it's regarded as the BAFTAs of the book trade. Well, this year, judging for the awards took place in March and April, and for the first time, the awards themselves happened in a digital ceremony. Now, the bookseller runs the British Book Awards. It's been the weekly business magazine for the book trade since 1858. And the editor, Philip Jones, joins me now. Good to speak to you again, Philip.
Hi, Georgina. How are you?
Good, good. Now, the British Book Awards, or the NBBYs, are a huge deal and normally accompanied by a glittering ceremony. And I remember last year it was a fabulous party. How was it this year in the digital space?
Well, interesting. I mean, I had a very small party involving me and a glass of cheap sparkling wine. Fortunately, I live with one of the publishers who actually won an award this year. No clash of conflicts there. And I was able to join in their sort of celebration that they were having on Zoom. So that was quite nice. But obviously, you know, it went to a much bigger audience and it was fun to watch it all roll out on Twitter. But it's very different. And I would say not quite the same thing as all gathering at the Grosvenor for a big, you know, black tie dinner and party and, you know, with dad dancing at the end. So it's a very different thing. And I think in preference, I'd go back to the Grosvenor. But I think we've learned a lot from doing it digitally. One is that you get to a much bigger audience and it's a much more kind of democratic show.
Well, who came out on top was really, really interesting. And of course, the one sort of major theme that goes through this, through the winners, and we'll look at who those people are in a moment, is that there were a lot of black writers taking the top prizes.
Yeah, and a big moment for the trade, you know, in light of the Black Lives Matter protests and the Booksellers' Own Rethinking Diversity report that we did with a couple of academics and Spread the Word that we published only 2 weeks ago. I mean, the interesting thing about the British Book Awards, of course, is that we are rewarding not just quality of writing, which is important, but it's not the only thing we look at. We're also looking at the publishing and the level of sales achieved by these books. So what this means, when Queenie wins overall Book of the Year, for example, it means not only is that book being beautifully well written by Candice Carty-Williams, but it's been brilliantly published by Trapeze, an imprint of Orion, but it means it's sold a lot of copies. And I think that's a big moment for the trade in general, because they have tried to publish diversely over many years, somewhat falteringly, but it hasn't always fed through into actual book sales. So to me, it's really important that the awards not only recognise that the books are out there, but actually that they've sold very well. They're breakthrough books. As Bernadine Evaristo, one of our other winners, argued on Twitter, she said, you know, the commercial argument has been won, and it has.
Yeah, so I mean, there's no suggestion that this was just seizing the moment and putting these black writers forward, because this is the narrative at the moment. These are absolutely backed up by sales. And as you say, they are all fantastic books.
Yeah, and obviously the judging took place well before the current protests that happened around Black Lives Matter. So I don't think it even came up in the judging. I didn't sit in on all the judging sessions, but it certainly didn't come up when we discussed Queenie for overall Book of the Year. Obviously, the fact that the main character is black and it's about black experience is very important, but it wasn't that sort of wider context didn't impact, I don't think, on the actual judging, which is based, as I say, on the quality of the book, the publishing, and the fact that it sold bucket loads of copies.
As did Oyinkan Braithwaite's book, My Sister the Serial Killer. Now, this is a book that I absolutely love. And although it's set in Nigeria, very sort of firmly anchored perhaps in Nigerian culture, it could be anywhere. I mean, it's a book that speaks to, I think, young women all over the world.
Well, it spoke to me, actually. I mean, it probably, in pure sort of freshness and enjoyability, probably one of the books I most enjoyed from the shortlist. I'm not a massive reader of crime and thriller books, because I do tend to find them a little bit formulaic, but we had a really, really strong shortlist. But this book just came through because it's just so fresh, it's so different, it gives such a kind of unique angle to things. It's written like you might watch a Netflix series, very episodic. The main characters are just a joy, even though they are, well, at least one of them is involved in murder, shall we say, and the sister is clearly a culprit in that. I mean, it's just a delight from start to finish, really, and also quite short, which is always good, I think, but really packs a punch.
Yeah.
I thought it was just an amazing book, and I think she's one writer who I will really look out for. As other books come through from her, I think she's a real talent.
I had a lovely conversation with her, and we were talking about this book, and she was saying that she kind of dashed it off while she was waiting to write, in capitals, the novel. And she said that this book was a kind of byproduct while she was waiting to be clever and literary about something. And in fact, she has this huge success. And listeners can hear that conversation on Meet the Writers. As you say, Bernadine Evaristo was a not only this, but she has won so much recently. Girl, Woman, Other is just fabulous. She is Author of the Year.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, obviously these awards, looking back to 2019, it was really, she's written a lot of books, and we've looked at her in the past, and my colleague and fellow judge Alice O'Keefe raves about her whenever she releases a new book, but she's not really had that kind of breakthrough book, which I think she mentioned in her awards reception video. She mentioned her publisher at Hamish Hamilton and said that a lot of it's been really committed to her, but it probably hasn't made a lot of money from her. And that's that's something about publishing, isn't it, that it can still commit to writers even though it can take a number of books, I think in this case 10 books, before one breaks through. But 2019 absolutely proved to be her year, didn't it? Not only was the book incredibly well received, it obviously won the Booker, and then she's become such a voice, I think, now in the trade and outside the trade for pushing a sort of diversity angle on everything and talking very, very eloquently about her experiences in publishing and how she's had to kind of fight that cause right from the get-go. So, you know, she's become, I think, she's the booker clearly helped, the book clearly helped, but I think it's mostly about her. She's such an eloquent advocate for the causes that she espouses. I think it's been a tremendous year, and we were delighted to give her that accolade. And also the book, Girl, Woman, Other, was the fiction book of the year as well. So it's a double win for her. Dorothy Williams, she didn't mince her words either when she got the award. She absolutely nailed, you know, what it was about and what the industry had to do to carry on, you know, this sort of evolution and change that everyone is talking about.
And do you think that this change will stay, not only in terms of diversity, but I wonder what's had to happen because of the pandemic? How is that going to impact the future of literature?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question. So I've been speaking to a few big publishers this week, and one of them said that they're having a golden period. Now, isn't that remarkable? Lockdown, bookshops only opened in the past couple of weeks in England, and only opening soon in Scotland and Wales. And yet, for the big publishers, they're having actually a pretty good time. So that's good in a way, because obviously it means they've got more money to invest, and they've got more money to invest hopefully wisely and diversely in a range of authors, such as Candice and Oyinka. But on the complete flip side, you talk to some more publishers and indie presses, and they're having a terrible time. They're very reliant on bookshops. They get fewer books into supermarkets. They're not as well marketed on Amazon as some of the big publishers can afford to be. So they're having an absolute terrible time. So it's become a real sort of, I think, issue of the haves and have nots in publishing. So obviously, in terms of, you know, the conversation around diversity, which is only going to grow and grow and grow, and I think will help publishers in having to approach this thing. I said, you know, one of the things about the awards is that, as Bernardine says, it's shown the argument really has been won. But I think there still needs to be a kind of unceasing commitment to it. But if on the one hand you have the big publishers able to invest because they're actually having a fairly decent time and they have quite a lot of money, and then you have the small presses who are not able to invest and maybe going to the wall because they're not able to get sales out there and generate business, then are we really going to have the true sort of diversity that we want? Because I don't think it's just going to come from the big publishers. We do need it to come from the smaller players as well, who historically and traditionally have been the ones who have really pushed into those areas. So, you know, swings and roundabouts, I'd say, Georgina.
Yeah, well, of course, the bookseller does champion all of these people and sponsors the British Book Awards. Philip is the editor there. Philip Jones, thanks very much for speaking to me. And that's all we have time for today. This programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello. Our studio engineer was Nora Hull. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I can tell you that I'm about to pop off with Emma Nelson. Both of us, as you probably know, present Over the Weekend and The Globalist, our early morning current affairs show, and we thought that it was time we caught up and had brunch together. Sadly, this leaked somehow to our producers. I don't quite know how they found out about it, but anyway, we're now being forced to take a microphone to our brunch so you can hear all about it on The Globalist on Monday morning. This is Monocle on Saturday. It will return, of course, at the same time next week.